Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com. This week, Steve Lefebvre. You remember him maybe from the BBC. And he's now on Made in Bristol. Also, Mehrnaz Shahabi from Bristol Against Imperialism, a kind of Bristol Stop the War group, a new generation. And she'll be talking about Aleppo, for or liberation. Then James Files. He's the shooter that killed John F. Kennedy. And he'd be talking this week about the Chicago mobster, Johnny Roselli, who was with him in Dallas that day. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk. And if you want to join in, contact the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street. I'll give full contact details at the end of the show. Until recently, he was doing the breakfast show on BBC Radio Bristol, which was insultingly called Radio Anywhere by the Bristol Post. Steve Lefebvre's joined me now. Hi, Steve.
Hello.
Steve, tell us a bit about your origins in getting into radio in the first place. Where are you from and how did you do it?
Well, I'm from a town called Larne on the east coast of Northern Ireland. And I, broadcasting-wise, sort of cut my teeth in Belfast during the height of the Troubles. So I was in the newsroom in Belfast when the Nick Witchells of this world and various others were camping out in sleeping bags up the corridors waiting for the next atrocity to happen, quite literally.
How did you get into something like that?
Well, how I got in the first place, I was going to be an actor was the big plan originally. Went to university and did an English degree and various things. Did a year in a workshop in the Bogside, which is one of the most illuminating years of my life, actually. But that's another story. But how I got into broadcasting was there is a big broadcasting house in the centre of Belfast, very similar to London, big grey corner building. And I knocked on the door, front door. The commissioner came out. They had commissioners in those days. It wasn't that long ago, Tony, either. And said, you know, how can I help? I said, I want to read the news. So he didn't know what to do with me, took me to the reception and I repeated the scenario and they didn't know what to do. So they eventually called the head of presentation, a gentleman by the name of Michael Bagley with this great moustache, and he brought me up and we had a chat and I said I want to present on television news and so on, and I got a voice test and got a 6-month contract, and that kind of started the whole thing, basically. It rolled from there.
Okay,
I ended up doing 2 years in sport a little bit after.
What year was that though?
It was in the 80s, late 80s,
right.
Just 80s into the
90s. Now, the Troubles, because one of the things, myself having worked during the Troubles at the BBC, we used to get these calls, didn't we, saying...
Yeah.
There's a bomb.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Oh, it was very, very frequent. You know, they rang with a code, basically the paramilitaries, and you were then able to suss whether it was. There were a lot of bomb scares as well, you know, that people were ringing up and all sorts of things. But it was a way of life. I mean, they said about Northern Ireland at that time, and I think I can't remember the exact politician who said there's an acceptable level of violence, which became sort of one of the most amazing phrases I've ever heard in doing TV politics and national radio and so on since. But there was an air, a strange air of normality about the place. It was a very friendly place. There was very little normal crime. There were very few muggings or burglaries. But there were the Troubles, this kind of euphemism for what went on over there. And if you just minded your own business and went about your life, you had a fine time. But if you knew which areas maybe not to go into, it was best to stay away from. If you did that, there was a great air of normality. But we got used to just going into city centres through gates and being searched by the army and your car stopped, you know, as you approached an airport and things stuck underneath it to check there were no explosives. And, you know, you sort of got, in a way, desensitized to what
was going
on.
Were you very careful about what parts of Belfast you went into at what times and that sort of thing?
I was. There were certain instances where I would have a liaison with a girlfriend from the other side of the divide, if you like, and I would end up going to maybe into areas like Dungannon and County Tyrone, which you know, are very much the other culture I'd never been to before. And you know, you kind of would have at that time get warned about that, but you know, loves young things, sort of conquers all in some ways, and there's a bit of naivety about it, and you tend to get on with your life. I mean, when I was growing up, Tony, I mean, in the street I lived on, there were I'm Protestant, I'm atheist, but I'm Protestant, but there were Catholics.
Is that
living
possible
there.
To be a Protestant atheist?
It's very well. I see. There's an old apocryphal story actually about a guy driving down a road and gets stopped by the paramilitaries. That's happened in country lanes, and these guys with balaclavas stuck the gun in and said to the guy driving, he says, are you Protestant or Catholic? And the guy said, well, God, what's the answer to that? Because he didn't know what they were.
Right.
You know? So he came up with a fantastic answer. He said, actually, I'm atheist. And the guy thought for a minute with a gun and said, are you a Protestant atheist or a Catholic atheist? So it's kind of the same thing. It's a good question to ask, actually, because, you know, as in all of the trouble spots of the world, it's a cultural thing as opposed necessarily to a religious thing. You know, and it's a battle over land and
strange, isn't it? Because we got sold this as a religious conflict, and yet actually it was the Good Friday Agreement, which both the Protestants and the Catholics would go for. Mm. And should we maybe say both the nationalists and the unionists that brought it to an end. I mean, did you see that coming? Because it was, I mean, we kept seeing these kind of agreements, didn't we, that didn't stick over the years.
We did. I think as far as sort of maybe the IRA were concerned, the armed struggle, as they would call it, clearly wasn't going to work. In the end, they did sort of sway towards the bullet in the ballot box, as they would call it. So you'd get the rise of Sinn Féin, the political arm of the IRA. As happens in all of these situations, you can see it happening in this country, in America at the minute, people get polarised and they get pushed towards the extremes. And the two more extreme parties of the DUP for the unionist side and the Sinn Féin for the nationalist side prevailed, you know, and became a battle of wills. So when it came to the power sharing situation at that time, I suppose there was a sense of weariness of war, if you like, and maybe it was the right time for that to happen.
Now, since then, a lot has come out about collusion between the British Army and, you know, it looks as if they had agents right in the middle of the IRA as well. Mm. A bit of a fine line between infiltrating and actually then starting to steer these terrorist organisations. Did you have any inkling at the time that this sort of thing was going on, this, you know, almost a double game being played?
Not specifically. Nothing would surprise you as to what does go on. I think that with the Good Friday Agreement, when people decide to have almost an amnesty, you know, for the problems on both sides, because horrors were carried out on both sides, both of the debate and you know, in the wider picture as well, I must admit I do find it strange these numbers of years later to say, okay, well, that side can have an amnesty, but this side we're going to probe into what went on. You know, I think either you decide, let's leave it where it is, try and get new generations. One of my great passions, and what is still not happening, is just to get fresh generations of people coming into politics in that country, whereby they're not involved, they had no involvement really in what went on during the 70s, the 60s, 70s and 80s, and you just get a freshness of politics.
Well, in the early 90s, the rave scene was very big, of course, and I can remember some friends of mine were running raves in Ireland, in Northern Ireland, and these were a place where both young Protestants and young Catholics from all sides of the culture divides were going. And then, of course, we found, oh no, these raves were illegal, and then they were being shut down. That was a potential kind of healing of the generations there that was actually made illegal.
Well, I think that's, you've put your finger on it in some ways. You know, I mean, one of my big bugbears is segregation, and that's been going on in that country for so long. There's still a peace, what they call, ironically, a peace wall in Belfast, separating two communities in this day and age, and you're hearing it from America about building walls. Let's knock these walls down.
Is it going to come down, that wall?
I have no idea, Tony. I don't know. It's probably there for safety reasons, but you know, when you've got segregated schools and that's slowly being changed, you know, and there is an element of, I watched politics programs from the country. I'm still very attached to it. A lot of friends, family still living there. And when I watch those sorts of programs, I see a great sense of normality that there never was before. You know, when I was there, you talked about nothing but sectarian politics. You know, you didn't talk about sort of employment or, you know, the NHS or any of the subjects that would sort of be normal here.
And how did that work its way out in the newsroom, though? Because, I mean, one would have hoped that you'd have an equal kind of people from both communities sitting in that newsroom together.
Oh, you do, yes. Sorry, I didn't quite understand what you meant.
If you're going to be reporting on it, yeah. You know, both sides want to make sure that they're represented amongst those reporters.
One thing I will say, and looking back on it, is that there just was no sense of that. I mean, we knew people were Catholic reporters, Protestant reporters. They did the job. I mean, there was just an incredible sense of professionalism about it, you know, and I take my hat off to them. I think the reporting was very, very fair. But it's just that there was no room for ordinary news, and that was the problem. The big news made the headlines. It still is. to a great degree.
Okay, what about coming to Bristol? Did you come via various other places?
Not at all, no. Yeah, I left Northern Ireland and went to Leeds to do a talk show on radio, which went very, very well. Got a Sony Award for that. It was a mid-morning talk show, one of the first, actually, in the change.
So were you bringing
local radio
callers in as well?
Or? Yeah, we lost the music, and that was the big thing for local radio at that time. The station, they were trying a different move whereby... It was all speech, and up until I think sort of 2 PM, our state radio Leeds was. So we did a talk show, and what we did was the age profile then changed completely. It was 8 to 80. You know, if you play music, you're saying, well, if you play Kylie, it's for whatever age group, you know, and so on, One Direction. But get rid of the music, and there's no discrimination age-wise. So we found that within a few weeks, even people driving across the Pennines to Manchester were suddenly ringing into the station, hearing your discussion, and we talked about things people wanted to talk about, you know, and that is the key, I think, to good radio, is that you touch the people who are listening. Learned a hell of a lot from that. But then I went on from that to TV in Leeds and Radio 5 Live, which, again, was a great sort of learning curve for me in taking the current
affairs. Okay, what was the difference then? Because this national radio, actually, you're still just in a studio talking to a microphone.
Absolutely right, but there's more pressure. I mean, quite simply, you know, the great movers and shakers are listening. The people who know the business intimately. There is technically no difference, you know. And the one thing I will say, and I'm a massive fan of localized radio. And what I would say is that anything I've ever done, sort of on any level, I think you can do local radio, but do it to a network standard. And if you can't do that, then don't do it. You know, but for something to be shoddy or slapdash just because it's local, I don't see an excuse for that. And I love radio when it's done well.
Well, there's a lot of criticism of Radio Bristol, and this has been going on for years now, that it isn't really very local, that a lot of the expertise, the staff, presenters, even including yourself, without any, you know, anything saying anything specific, aren't actually really part of Bristol's history, culture, that sort of thing.
I'm not with Radio Bristol, so I don't really want to make an apology for Radio Bristol. What I would say is, I'm not dodging the question. I got a lot of flack for about the first year because I wasn't from the area, and I can understand that.
And I can talk, I've never been on Radio Bristol, but I'm from London.
But what I would say is that I won that audience over because I love where I am. I finished about a year ago. I'm staying in Bristol. I know every nook and cranny of this city and beyond. My boys are on the university now. I sit in the back of the car and laugh because I'm like a tour guide. You know, I'm sort of pointing things out as I go. And the audience realised that passion and that love. I go to the football. I'm passionately involved. I actually walk around to see how the bridge is getting on at Finsel's Reach. You know, I'm actually a nerd for the city. So that love and passion, if I didn't do that, I wouldn't be able to do the job. Or stay where I am, you know. So I think this business of you've got to be born and brought up and have 7 generations of family living in Bristol before you can call yourself Bristolian is insulting to the people who actually do come
from
the place.
I think the criticism is that it's almost to the exclusion of the local accent, the local culture.
Fair enough. I think in any walk of life, does that mean that everybody plays for Bristol City or Bristol Rovers should have a Bristol accent?
I suppose at one time they probably did.
They did, but, you know, it's living in the past, isn't it? I think people like diversity. Isn't it terribly discriminatory to say something like that, though, to suggest that you can only work for a radio station?
I don't think that's quite what was being said by the... I'm thinking about a couple of years ago now. There was a whole series of people writing into the Bristol Post saying, calling it Radio Anywhere, you know, so they didn't really feel that it had a local identity.
Yeah. As I say, I'm not with the station, so I don't really want to be an apologist for the station. It's changed direction a lot of times.
What do you think about the way the BBC's going?
Massive question. What I would say is, from the news point of view, is and Radio Bristol, it falls into this category. They've fallen victim to social media, and that's not just the BBC. That's the main news organisation. So news is no longer news. You wake up at 8 o'clock in the morning, used to put the news on to get your local news or to get your local weather. You don't do that. You reach over and you get your smartphone at 7:50, and you've got all the news you need. So what news stations and what local radio? Why local radio is suffering terribly is, as far as that's concerned, is they've got to find a different way of presenting it, a different way of reaching their audience.
Do you think they're doing that?
Well, they're doing it through social media. You know that the radio stations are now using social media almost as much, if not more, than the broadcast. And I think that is, you know, to the detriment of some of the presenters.
I think they used to do a slot called Sorted. I think it was called Sorted on Radio Bristol, which I used to listen to. Probably the only thing I really regularly used to hear, apart from the David Lowe show on a Sunday night.
Yeah.
And that was where consumers rang in with, look, I've got a problem with Bristol Water. They're, you know, taking me to court for something I've not done, this kind of thing.
Yes.
And that seemed to be almost like the spirit of the station lost something when it lost that ability to, you know, for a radio station to be able to contact the big guys and say, hang on, what's going on here?
I agree. Well, you haven't listened to the station, I'll be telling you stuff that you haven't heard. But what I did bring to the station was what they call accountability, which they didn't have before I came. In other words, the big people, the movers and shakers, were put on the spot on the breakfast show. They were asked the questions the public wanted to hear, and they got the answers. And I got a great support from the people of Bristol because of that. They said, actually, we're getting the answers. We didn't, you know, when the arena's held up, they're put on the spot and question, you know, answers are demanded. And that's the kind of background I've got, you know, that you can do that.
Is the arena a good thing that Bristol City Council should be paying for?
I'm distraught that it's been held up for another year, 2 years. I think it's ridiculous. I think it's, you know, I'm delighted to see the Colston Hall getting its renovations. It's the last, would you believe, major hall of that type in the country not to get renovated. We're the last of the core cities not to have an arena. This city is a brilliant place to live.
Should council taxpayers be building an arena?
Well, what is this the argument? Should the money not be spent on hospitals and so on? Well, it's earmarked money.
Well, a hospital is not an arena, is it? A hospital is for everybody.
I think you look at the finances, though, Tony. You know, I think, should we have a tram in this city? Should we have a tramway? Look at the, you know, by the exactly the same argument, when you get local politicians quibbling to such an extent that something like £200 million is just taken away because they can't agree on where it goes, I think that's shocking.
So why aren't we hearing you on Radio Bristol anymore?
I'm not with Radio Bristol. I've moved on from Radio Bristol.
So is that your choice or their choice?
No, I came to the end of a contract. The station changed direction. The people I worked with before were no longer there. So
I'm doing other things. Somewhere else?
Yeah. I mean, I'm doing a lot of TV in various places this year. So and also,
anywhere we can watch out for you popping up?
Well, as you probably know, I've been doing a lot of the politics on Made in Bristol, which is the very much the local television station here, you know. So we had a fantastic run at both Brexit and the mayoral elections. In fact, did probably the biggest coverage of any of the stations on that, with individual 12-minute interviews on each of them over 12 nights. But yeah, there'll be a lot more stuff coming up this year.
Is that commercially viable?
Is what, sorry?
Made in Bristol?
It's doing extremely well, yes. It's a commercial station. It's doing very well for advertising. That's how you can judge by watching these things. You see the advertising that they're getting. And Chris James, who's responsible for putting the thing together, has done a tremendous job with very little resources. And that's very, very admirable. Sort of going back to your local radio discussion.
Now, back in November, I think it was November the 15th, Google launched their fake news app. Mm-hmm. So you can put it onto your Google Android phone or your browser, and it will tell you if you're looking at fake news.
Yes.
What do you make of this fake news? Is it really fake?
I think it's been around since the Roman times, hasn't it? Fake news. It's been used as propaganda. I think people have suddenly fallen onto it. You know, there's a great deal of outcry, isn't there, about, you know, from social media. It can be brilliant on one hand, but can be terribly, terribly destructive on the other. And one of the main things it does is get people's attention span. You know, to such a narrow level, and then sort of it's a black and white outrage or pleased with something, you know. So fake news is just, I think, a byproduct of that outrage, you know. I think.
But hang on, because the mainstream press it was that told us about weapons of mass destruction, wasn't it? Not social media.
Well, I thought that was a dossier that mentioned that. I didn't think that was the media.
Well, yes, it was a guy called Andrew Gilligan at the BBC that said, this is a dodgy dossier, don't believe it, folks. Yeah. And he got sacked for his trouble, and we went to war with Iraq, didn't we?
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, the director general of the BBC too got sacked. They were trying, I suppose, to have a critique of it, but they weren't allowed to.
Yeah. Well, they weren't the ones who were saying that there were weapons of mass destruction, were they?
No, but surely it's a journalist's job to check facts. Yeah. They don't just take what the government say. It's not like a George Orwell world.
Exactly, but I think...
I mean, hopefully the BBC is not an official government broadcaster.
Yeah, like I say, I'm not an apologist for the BBC either, but I would say that the big news organisations, actually, when it comes to sussing out wrongdoings and keeping society right, it's the media that does it. Most of the big exposés come from the big newspapers, you know? Newspapers are a dying art now, but the investigative journalism that goes on, take Channel 4 News, for example, you know, some of the major exposés that they have created and righted wrongs. The Savile situation, again, exposed by the media, by investigative...
Well, actually, by a freelance journalist.
It was by investigative...
In the face of suppression, really, by the BBC.
It was investigative journalism, yeah.
Yeah.
So you know...
Do you have a favourite blogger?
No, I haven't. No. Perhaps I should have you.
I have lots of favourite bloggers.
Who's your favourite blogger?
In fact, I went through this fake news list that was put out by
John Darville. Writes a good blog. He's at BBC Radio Bristol. He writes a good blog.
This fake news list, which was put out by various sources, most of them US. I went through there and I found at least a third of those websites were actually very well sourced news.
Mm.
And so I think there's been a deliberate attempt to mix in some really good internet news sites with this complete rubbish.
I think the irony is to what you're saying, really, when you're trying to disorganize august organizations like the British Broadcasting Corporation, is that the sway seems to be now that people are actually going back to those organisations for their news because they can trust it. They know that the fake news probably isn't there. I think as a consumer, as a user, and as somebody who's grown up loving news, I take it from lots of different sources. You know, I listen to about three or four different radio stations in the day, from LBC through to Jeremy Vine on Radio 2 to get what the sort of Daily Mail listeners are talking about in Middle England, through to you know, other areas of Radio 4 and so on. I'm a big Five Live man. But you know, people are turning back to traditional news sources now because can you believe anything you see on the internet?
Of course. can you trust anything you see on the BBC News?
Well, you seem to have it in for the BBC.
No, I don't. I'm just because you're from the BBC.
I'm not from the BBC.
Not right now, yeah, but you've worked there.
Yeah, I've worked it.
And I think you've got...
I've worked it,
got a very easy way to lie to a massive amount of people if you've got access to the mainstream press.
Yeah, I've worked, yeah.
Whereas sometimes you'll find people simply cannot get the truth out through the mainstream press, so they turn to blogging.
Yeah.
I'm thinking of somebody like Craig Murray, for example, the former ambassador to Uzbekistan, who blew the whistle on torture over there and has just been, you know, basically a taboo on the mainstream press ever since. So he blogs.
Yeah.
And I don't agree with you when you say that people trust the mainstream press. I think increasingly young people get their news from social media.
Didn't quite say that. No, I said that people are turning back to the traditional news sources because there is so much fake news that you get, you know, where everybody can blog, everybody's got an opinion, everybody's got a say, which is all fair, which is all fine. But
well, it's like a minefield in the information warfare,
isn't it?
You don't know where to go.
Yeah.
Well, that's awful. Yeah. Anyway, we'll have to leave it there, but thanks, Steve Lefevre, for coming in and talking. We said we weren't going to talk politics, but we did, didn't we?
You were determined to do so, and I was very happy to do so.
Okay, Steve, thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
Great pleasure.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
And I'm joined now by Mehrnaz Shahabi. Mehrnaz is an anti-war campaigner, originally from Iran and also a founder of the Bristol Open Inquiry into Syria and to the attack on Syria. Have I got that right? What's the Open Inquiry?
Yes, hello. Thank you very much for inviting me. It is actually, I am one of the founding members of Bristol Open Inquiry into the UK bombing of Syria.
Right, so was there actually much in the way of British bombing, the RAF?
Well, we actually founded this after the UK Parliament voted for military intervention in Syria in 2014 in December, 2015 in December. And there was such volume of fake news and misrepresentation of what was happening in Syria.
Before it was fashionable.
They didn't talk about it. They didn't refer to fake news. But there was such misrepresentation of what was happening in Syria and distortion, not only from the mainstream media, but also inside the left, inside the anti-war movement itself. That means how propaganda was so powerful that we thought that it was necessary to set up a body that investigates into what is really happening, research seriously into what is happening in Syria.
So are you suggesting that some organisation like Stop the War even had sort of warring factions in there?
Well, I think the Stop the War, unfortunately, the positions that they have had, they have relied themselves on the mainstream fake news.
Oh, no.
For example, a lot of the information in the Stop the War itself in relation to the bombing, for example, they have been relying on information from InfoWar. Now, InfoWar has been getting its information from very compromised sources like Violation Documentation Center or Syrian Network for Human Rights.
And, so it sounds to me like InfoWar.
Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, the one-man show in Canterbury.
So InfoWars is itself an information war website.
Absolutely.
Amazing.
Absolutely. So we thought that it was necessary to set up something to challenge the propaganda, the war propaganda.
This is a phrase which we heard all about the BBC and the weapons of mass destruction in 2003 in the run-up to the invasion, illegal invasion of Iraq. And the mainstream media plays quite an important part in getting these wars started. I mean, we're looking at Iraq, we're also looking at Libya, what happened there, and now it's absolute chaos, a terrible place where, you know, 99% of Libyans now would say they much preferred things, the stability. Mm. You know, no leader is perfect. They're all gangsters pretty much, but under Gaddafi, and then Syria too.
Absolutely.
It doesn't seem to stop. But the mainstream media seems to play a big role in all this.
They do, and I think they are complicit in war crimes. I mean, we've got wars fought on various fronts, and then we've got a propaganda war, which enables it softens the public opinion for war. It enables wars, like, for example, calling for no-fly zone in Syria, that many even leftists and activists support. It would not have happened without Syria mainstream media and actually terrorists on the ground, not on the ground, actually in Turkey. And people like Syria Civil Defense called White Helmets that are the source of news for the mainstream media, propagating things that can enable, for example, a no-fly zone in Syria, which led to the collapse of Libya.
See, another thing they do, having a real go at the mainstream media here today, is that they just don't ask difficult questions. So the government will present a fact. We were talking about this no-fly zone in Syria, but they'll say, well, okay, so how are you going to enforce that? Does that mean you're going to go to war with Russia?
I think it's more sinister than not asking questions and believing the government. I think that there is a lot of information that when ordinary activists like myself can access, when the mainstream media don't. For example, one example is white helmets. There is a lot of information that substantiates that it is NATO funded, it's a propaganda tool, and they are terrorist affiliates. There are lots of films and photographs of these people working with the terrorists on the ground. And how can the BBC and Channel 4 rely on the information from the white helmets? That is why I think that they are actually an arm of the state. They are working for war rather than misunderstanding what is happening or being misinformed.
Well, they come along, I suppose, to big organisations and they say, we're there on the ground. Do you want to take our reports?
I'm sorry, I didn't understand.
So the white helmets will say we're there on the ground.
Well,
we have information.
It is very interesting because when East Aleppo was liberated, they were supposed to be giving the information from on the ground in East Aleppo. Now, when East Aleppo was liberated, journalists who were there, and one of them is Vanessa Bealey, they actually talked to people who were leaving East Aleppo, residents who had been liberated, and they were saying that they either didn't know fake Syria civil defense, or that the ones that did said that they were actually working with al-Nusra, which is the al-Qaeda in Syria. They were looking after the terrorists, and they didn't think of them as a humanitarian organization.
So what's the real agenda in Syria, do you think?
I think the real agenda in Syria, it is being presented to us that it is it was a revolution and it is a civil war or a sectarian war. And in fact, it's a regime change agenda, like the same that happened in Libya, the same has happened in Ukraine, and the same is happening in Syria. And the idea is to get rid of an independent government that does not follow the agenda of the United States, and actually Israel very much. The idea is to break up the region, the sort of old Yenon plan, and balkanize it in the same way that they have been trying to do that, creating sectarian conflicts, ethnic conflicts, to be able to break up the region in Syria, in Libya, in Iraq. They are having an eye on Iran, even finally in Saudi Arabia itself, to create statelets that would be continuously at war with each other.
Well, I mean, Syria doesn't really exist anymore. You've got the north, which is controlled by the Kurds and the Peshmerga, people like that. You've got parts of it in the east controlled by ISIS, and then you've got the Syrian government. So in a way, that's already been a success, that plan.
Well, I think the populated parts of Syria are actually under government control. The majority of the Syrian population are in government-controlled areas. But yes, it is a bloody war, but it is not a civil war. It's a war that has been imposed on Syria. Lots of what they call rebels, which they are actually mercenaries, they come from other countries, from Saudi Arabia, from the Chechens, they're from all over the place, Qatar, and even from United States and Western countries. These are mercenaries, and they are the militants in Syria themselves. They are being funded, armed and trained by these countries, by United States, Britain, France, and the satellite countries of Saudi Arabia.
Well, most people at the Foreign Office would say, well, we're not funding these terrorists.
Well, they actually are. They are funding the terrorists, they are training the terrorists, and they are assisting with the propaganda war.
Well, they are, aren't they? I suppose that, you know, they say that they're moderate rebels, don't they?
Yes, they call them the moderate rebels. And in fact, the Syrians themselves on the ground, they call them all terrorists. In fact, they don't distinguish between ISIS, al-Nusra, or what they call moderate terrorists. They are all really vicious mercenaries and sectarians. And the Syrians themselves do not distinguish. They call them all terrorists.
Now, we've got a couple of new figures in the White House under Donald Trump. Trump. We've got Rex Tillerson as the new Secretary of State. We've also got Mad Dog Mattis, who is the killer of Fallujah. He's the Defence Secretary. So some pretty hawkish characters. And I'm not sure which one of them it was, but one of the pair of them was talking about Iran as meddling in the Middle East.
Well, they have been doing that, but now it is really heating up. Trump himself is very anti-Iran, and the team that he's chosen are extremely anti-Iran. In fact, it's their common denominator. They're very anti-Iran sentiment. In fact, a week before Trump came to power, Democratic Congressman Hastings introduced a bill that it will be discussed in the Congress in March. That would give the president the authority to unilaterally, without further discussion with the Congress or any more votes, to unilaterally, preemptively attack Iran if they feel that Iran's nuclear program might be a threat to the security of the United States. And we know how something like that can be cooked up.
Now,
so
the
it
Americans
is an extremely dangerous bill.
Talking about Iran interfering in the Middle East, well, the thing is, Iran is in the Middle East. America isn't.
Exactly. I mean, Iran has been the main target of the United States in the Middle East.
But what they're saying is that there are all sorts of terrorists, people they would call terrorists, throughout the Middle East, including people that the Israelis don't like, that the Iranian government is helping. I'm thinking about, for example, the Houthi rebels in Yemen, Hezbollah, Hamas, people like that. Is that true?
Well, in relation to, yes, Iran has been helping Hezbollah. Iran has created Hezbollah. It doesn't mean that they are acting on behalf of Iran. They have got shared interests with Iran because they are under threat. Hezbollah, let us not forget, was the only force in the Middle East that stood up to Israel and defeated it in 2006. Firstly, kicked Israelis out of Lebanon and stood up to Israelis and defeated them in 2006.
I suppose the Israelis would be on the phone to America all the time saying, you know, the Iranians are the big troublemakers around here.
Well, they would say that. In relation to Houthis, it's actually very interesting that you mentioned that. Firstly, there is no evidence, actually, there is no evidence, substantiated evidence, that Iran has been arming the Houthis or that the Houthis are actually taking orders from Iran. In fact, there is evidence to the contrary. One of the things that happened last week was in relation to Iran testing a medium-range ballistic missile. Also there was the attack by Houthis on a Saudi Arabian Navy vessel. Now, the way that it was presented was that it was an attack by Iranians, not Houthis, an attack by Iranians on an American Navy. That was the White House spokesman who presented it like that.
Yeah, this is Sean Spicer, and he seems to be coming out with lots of fake news.
That's right. I mean, the whole administration is, in fact, they warned Iran, they gave a formal notice, they gave Iran a formal notice. Flynn, actually, gave Iran the advisor, National Security Advisor to Trump. They gave Iran a formal notice, whatever it means, we don't know. But in relation to the testing of the ballistic missile itself, they presented it as being against the nuclear deal. In fact, the nuclear deal doesn't mention using of ballistic missiles. There was a Security Council resolution which endorsed the nuclear deal, and the Security Council resolution calls on Iran. It doesn't prohibit Iran. It calls on Iran not to test or build ballistic missiles which are nuclear capable. And the missile that had been tested had not been nuclear capable. So there had been no flouting of Security Council resolutions or the deal, but they are using that as an excuse to heat up the anti-Iran environment. And the way that I see that is this sort of closeness of Trump to Russia. I can see that as a way of trying to create a divide between Russia, Iran, and China. So to make a deal, for example, in relation to this massive military build-up in Eastern Europe.
I mean, it does look as if in the Middle East, it looks as if war has been being cooked up for decades even maybe there between Iran and Israel, and that we're all being sort of coached to be on Israel's side.
That's
when
right,
it happens.
Yes.
Is that, yes. Would you agree? Because
we're
being steered to be very pro-Israeli, the Iranians are the bad guys, and it's almost as if this war is an inevitability, because all the time we're being, the whole tension is being ramped up.
Israel is at the center of it, because Israel wants to be the superpower in the region with complete supremacy. And it is not even the question of the nature of the government in Iran. Basically, Israel wants to be the supreme power in the region, and its interests are aligned with the interests of the United States, strategic
Well,
interests.
I can remember back in 1973, the October War in 73, where I think it was the Lebanese and the Syrians invaded Israel, attacked Israel anyway, at the Golan Heights and places like that. Immediately the Americans came to their aid with literally thousands of tons of military aid that came in by plane immediately. Obviously, if something was to break out, a war between Iran and Israel, the Americans would do the same. They'd be immediately coming in on the Israeli side.
Yes.
I mean, it's almost unthinkable to have such a war, because it would so quickly escalate.
It would definitely escalate, and it would be a ferocious war that actually make what's happened in Iraq and what's happening in Syria into kids' play. It would be a ferocious war.
Could either side win that war? Who's the stronger country?
Israel will have the backing of NATO countries and the United States, but I think it's much more complex than that. I think that still, I hope that there will be enough sanity for people to realize that such a war is not winnable. Also, I don't think that Russia and China will be able to sit back and allow Iran to be attacked, because their own national security interests will be endangered.
I mean, I suppose you'd have to be quite a brave military person in Iran to actually, even if you were attacked by Israel, to strike back, because knowing where it would lead.
Well, what Iran has always maintained is that we will not attack any country. We will not attack our enemies. But if we are attacked, we will ferociously retaliate. And I think there'll be no choice but to do that. And in relation to this missile program, they have said that it is really only for defensive purposes. And with the history of Iran-Iraq war, when Iraq was aided by almost all countries, apart from just a very small number of countries.
Well, it was the United States that put them up to it, wasn't it?
That's right. It was sort of war against Iran, and Iran was being bombed and it did not have any missiles to fight back. And Iran's foreign minister Zarif actually has said in a very moving video that we will not allow that to happen again. We have to look after, defend ourselves, after our interests.
Looking at the region, you mentioned Vanessa Bealey a little while ago. She is the daughter of former British ambassador to Egypt.
Right, yes.
And I know she's coming to Bristol very soon.
She is coming to Bristol. Bristol Open Inquiry into the UK bombing of Syria invited Vanessa on 4th of November. And we had a fantastic meeting in the Arc with nearly 90 people attending. And she exposed the fake news on Syria. Now, Vanessa went back to Aleppo again in December and witnessed the final stages of liberation of Aleppo, went to East Aleppo. She's one of the very, very few Western journalists, in fact, who have been on the ground in Aleppo and in East Aleppo.
Now, I've spoken to Vanessa, and I know that she does contact London media and says, look, I'm on the ground. They don't want to know.
No, they don't want to know. They don't want to know. I mean, Vanessa has been one of the people, the most vociferous person who's done research and exposed the nature of the white helmets. We have got a meeting with her on Friday, 17th of February, between 7 to 9 p.m. in the Arc, Broad Street, Bristol. Also Andrew Ashdown, who was in our previous meeting, Reverend Andrew Ashdown, who'd been on the ground in Syria, was in Syria again in December when Vanessa was there. and he's told me this afternoon that he'll be in the meeting as well and will be able to testify.
So anyone that's scratching their heads watching the BBC saying, I'm not sure if I believe what I'm being told here, get yourself down to the Ark on Broad Street at the bottom. Absolutely. On the left-hand side. What's the date and the time again?
It is Friday, 17th of February, between 7 to 9, Ark 27 Broad Street, BS1 2HG. And also the day after, Vanessa is having a meeting in Birmingham. I should actually mention that because really this is about imperialism, and what is happening in Syria is very much like what happened in Libya and what's happening.
It's like a kind of form of colonialism.
It is about regime change agendas in the interests of imperialism.
6,000 miles away.
Yeah, we have set up an umbrella body, which is Bristol Against Imperialism. So this meeting is jointly organised between Bristol Open Inquiry into UK bombing of Syria and Bristol Ukraine Anti-Fascist Solidarity, and we'll be having future meetings later about Iran and then Yemen and all the other countries to challenge fake news and to mobilize anti-war forces.
Menaz Chahabi, thank you very much for joining us on Dialect.
Thank you very much for asking me to come.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Here's a question I've always had. Johnny Roselli was actually pretty well known, and he was well known out in Hollywood. He was kind of flashy dresser.
Very flashy, very loud, liked to spend money, and liked for everybody to know basically what he was doing when he was in town. He wanted everybody to know he was there.
Why would the mob put somebody like that in on such an important hit as JFK?
Johnny Roselli had all the right connections. The reason Johnny Roselli was brought into all this, he had the right connections. He was the last, like I say, between the government and the crime, you know, the crime people, mafia, what are you going to call them, outfit organization, crime family, you know, different names for them. They brought him in on it, not because of us. And I think Chuck wanted to use him more or less specifically because of the connections and the cooperation and the help that we could receive. This is only what I say. This is not fact. I got no documented proof on it. Nobody never sit me down and told me that. This is where I draw my own conclusions.
So he could kind of provide you with some high-level cover.
Right. High-level cover from Johnny Roselli's side. And at this point of the game, when I went down there, I did not know at that time that the CIA was heavily involved in any of this. After I talked to David Phillips to let him know where I'm at, and then when Lee Harvey Oswald shows up on the scene, I have at this point become aware. Only two people knew where I was, Charles Nicoletti and David Ferrer, or David Phillips. Excuse me.
Start over.
Okay. At this point of the game, only two people know where I'm at, Charles Nicoletti and David Phillips. Lee Harvey Oswald shows up at my hotel. This tells me automatically David Phillips is in on it. David Phillips knows what's going down. So otherwise, Oswald would never be there.
So Oswald was working for the agency.
Oswald was CIA... All the way. Oswald was CIA before I ever even knew any of these people. Oswald was recruited when he was in the Marine Corps. Lee Harvey Oswald knew David Phillips by several names. He knew his real name. He knew him by different aliases. He knew him by different code names. Lee Harvey Oswald had known David Phillips a lot longer than I had.
And Phillips had several aliases.
David Phillips, he used a lot of aliases. One of his most famous, one of them I can remember, was Maurice Bishop. And Maurice Bishop had been in a lot of controversy, whether it was him or it wasn't him. He's had other names, but right, and like I said, I can't even remember all the different names. I can't even remember all the names I've had on different passports with my picture on it and different pictures and everything, you know.
What is your real name?
My real name is James Sutton.
And you were born when?
I was born January 24th, 1942, in Alabama. And if you find my birth certificate, it will plainly state deceased at birth.
How was that arranged?
I have no idea, but I was trying to get a birth certificate for my own records, and they could not locate one at first. And the lawyer in Alabama went through everything, went to the Capitol, and when he got through, he found it 3 months later, I had a birth certificate in there that says deceased at birth.
Now, can the mob do something like that, or is that the government?
That's only the government. Mob knows a lot of things. They got ways to get things done, but when it comes into this kind of stuff, that's out of their category. I'm going to tell you, when it comes to government and underhanded work, the mob, they're kindergarten. They're kindergarten. I might upset a lot of people in the family saying that, but they're kindergarten when it comes to working with the government. They're the goldfish in the shark's pond.
What kind of man was David Alley Phillips?
David Alley Phillips was a very secure man, a lot of class, quiet. He was like domineering. He demanded like attention. When he was with you, he was around. He had a presence about him all his own. He was like he was a command. He was somebody, when he said something, you listened.
What kind of man was Charles Nicoletti?
Charles Nicoletti, very quiet, well-defined. I only heard Mr. Nicoletti swear on a few occasions. He did not use a lot of profanity like they portrayed him in Double Cross. Charles Nicoletti mostly got upset when there was FBI involved. And there were several different times that that happened. But like I say, Nicoletti was a quiet type of person. He didn't go out talk about anything that he had done. He didn't go out and get drunk. I never saw the man drunk. He might take a sociable drink here and there. But he was not a man to use profanity.
You just told us, fucking we go. Mm-hmm.
That, said that. That was one of the times.
Huh?
That was one of the times when he said, oh, fuck him, we're going.
Oh, that was one of the times, definitely, when they called it off. Another time I remember was in Melrose Park. We had the car up on the grease rack in the Shell station there. It used to be a Broadway and Division. And there's a car parked out front. And I told Chuck, I said, Mr. Nicoletti, I says, I don't know who it is over there. We might have a problem. And he looked over and he said, I don't know. He said, we'll watch him for a few minutes. So they went ahead. They serviced his car. And they kept sitting out there. And they was parked a little ways down from the station, like. That would be on the east side of the street because Broadway runs north and south. Division runs east and west. And at that time, the Shell station sit on the northwest corner. Yeah, northwest corner. On the northeast corner was a Gulf gas station. And they was parked just beyond that, front of two flat down there. They kept staring and they kept watching us. The Chuck said, I got to see who they are. He says, Jimmy, he says, cover me. So I told the kid doing the grease job on the car, and he watched me. He says, lower the car a minute. When they lowered it, I walked around back in the overhead door. I had them pull that down so they couldn't see what we were doing in there. I opened the trunk up and I took a rifle out. Got that out. They raised the car back up in the air. And I went over by one of the windows or crawl up on like the workbench back there and opened one of the windows up and I went out the back way. Then I crawled up on the roof. And I got up behind the Shell sign. And I told Chuck, I says, give me 2 minutes and then go. He walked out. He walked across the parking lot and he was well dressed. He had kind of like his right hand down by his little watch pocket like we carried a small caliber weapon there. And I got the guy, the driver, like zeroed up. Anybody picks up a gun, they're going to get it. He got to the middle of Broadway, and the car pulled out and took off. So we don't know who it was. But the only thing he said inside when it started to go, when I started got the gun out, he said, it's got to be the fucking feds. And that was one of those times he was very upset. But they used to really paranoid him.
Okay. These are stories we want to hear, but...
Yeah, I understand, yeah.
We need to focus on Kennedy's, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because this is burning tape.
Right. Did Wolfman have any idea of... those mercury loads he made, did he have any idea what they were going to be used for?
When Wolfman, when I asked him to make the special rounds, the only thing he ever asked me was, he says, do you need any help? He never asked me what I was doing because he would never breach that borderline, whatever you want to call it there. In the trade, you just don't ask people what they're going out to do. But when I told him what I wanted done and what I needed made, he told me to do it. The only thing was he said, he kind of grinned at me, he said, you need any help? And I said, no, this is straight. And he said, okay.
So he really didn't know.
He said, see me in a couple of days.
That's all for this week. Dialects Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. If you're online, you could subscribe to our emails or download the podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, Steve Lefebvre, late from the BBC Breakfast Show, also Mayor Naz Shahabi from Bristol Against Imperialism. And we also heard there from James Files, from the Chicago mob who killed John F. Kennedy, the US president. Also the studio engineer, Dave Bazanko. Dialects of Bristol Broadband Co-op production. Catch us on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. Contact us through the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street, on 0117 909 6897 or prsc.org.uk. You can also go to the Volunteering Bristol website on 0117 989 7733. That's one word, volunteerbristol.org.uk. or the National Volunteering site, where you can volunteer anywhere in the country to do almost anything. That's do-it.org. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week, goodbye for now.
Shout, I'll try to swim and pull you out.